Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, your host. We are into October, and this month is all about breast cancer awareness. And today, we are discussing new developments in breast cancer screening and treatment with none other than Dr. Laura J. Esserman from UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center. Joining Dr. Esserman on the patient panel are breast cancer advocates April Stearns and Kelsey Smith. To get the discussion started, we have with us Dr. Laura Esserman, surgeon-oncologist who has been co-leading the breast cancer oncology program at UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center for more than two decades. Dr. Esserman, it's such a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here.
So my first question is doubt clearance, you can say. So while I was researching for today's talk, I found a very common discussion in various forums, which was about a difference between screening for breast cancer and early diagnosis. It would be great if you could help us understand the difference, if there is one.
Well, I think one of the things that people confuse is screening and prevention in particular. So the idea behind screening really started in the 1980s, and it came from our understanding that people with early stage disease did much better than people with late stage disease. Now, back then, we all thought that breast cancer was simply one disease. And so it made sense that if only we could, the earlier we could find these cancers, the better off we'd be. This really became sort of the mantra, how the mantra for early detection saves lives. So the idea of screening is really to find cancers at a very early stage. That really is the purpose of screening. Screening is not prevention. It is really the idea that if only we could find every cancer at this really small stage, that the problems with breast cancer would go away. But unfortunately, that did not solve all of our problems. The incidence of breast cancer has gone up over time, and we have had an increase in the rise of these very small cancers without an equal drop in the risk of the big cancers. So some of the later stage cancers went down, but nowhere near as much. And what we learned from that was, there's also a bunch of small, low-risk cancers that may be different from these high-risk cancers. So it's really just highlighted the point that breast cancer isn't one disease. It's many diseases, and some of them are small and indolent and are never going to be destined to be killer cancers. And some are killer cancers even when they're small. So I think the issue is that our notions of screening have to evolve as our understanding of the biology of breast cancer has evolved, and as our treatments are changing. So we're learning how to personalize treatments for breast cancer, and we now have to learn how to personalize our approach to screening. And as well, that opens the door for us thinking about how do we personalize and think differently about how to prevent breast cancer, not just screen for it.
So what we're essentially saying is that screening is performed to find the disease before the symptoms begin.
Yes, before symptoms begin, but when it is still detectable as a cancer, as a small cancer.
Yeah, and the goal would be to detect the disease at its earliest and, as you said, at the most treatable stage.
Right, that was the goal, but there are things never work out quite as you hope. And again, we designed this when we thought that every breast cancer was the same and that every breast cancer was on this path to grow, kind of slowly grow and become a bad cancer. That turns out not to be the case. They're just different kinds of cancers that grow at very different rates. And so some cancers, again, the best analogy I can make is to prostate cancer, because people, I think, understand that.
Yeah.
The rise of PSA screening has been very controversial because it led to the detection of many small prostate cancers, many of which would never really become a clinical problem if they weren't detected, and it led to overtreatment. So overdiagnosis and hard treatment, and that, again, what's happened is it's not that all screening is bad, and it's that we just have to broaden our understanding of what happens when you screen in any disease. When you screen, you will find more people with these early stages of disease, some of whom are going to go on and get something bad, but many of whom may not. So we have to then develop plans and strategies to separate out who has the good risk cancers and the bad risk cancers. How do we evolve screening so that it's more purposeful and we're finding and the consequential cancers and reducing the risk in that way?
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Simon, what are the current recommendations for breast cancer screening? And it would be great if you could touch upon what age should screening begin and who should screen and some of the screening methods, because these are some of the questions that we've received from our audience.
Well, that is a perfect question. And I would say we don't really have the right answer to that, which is why we're running a big trial called the Wisdom Study. So there are at least seven recommendations from professional societies in the United States alone, none of which exactly agree. You know, I think the consensus is that women over 50 should be screened. The question is, should it be 1 year, every 1 year, should it be every 2 years? In the United Kingdom, they do it every 3 years. You know, around the world, screening is also very different. And the question is, should you start at 40? Should you start if you have a family history? When do you start? Some people say, you know, 40, some people say 45, some people say 50. The recommendations are all over the map. And I was recently talking to a healthcare professional who said, my gosh, my mom died of breast cancer screening. I'm in the healthcare field, and I don't know when to start or what test to use. And this is very confusing for women. And, you know, so the University of California at San Francisco started up a network called the Athena Breast Health Network. It was originally the five University of California Medical Center campuses and now has extended to include Sanford Health in the Midwest and the University of Chicago in Illinois and soon Minnesota and Alabama. So we're really trying to put a network together to really tackle some of these big questions. And we are really trying to answer the question, when should you start, stop, how often should you screen, and what modality, and should we be integrating screening with prevention? So we're testing what some consider to be the gold standard, which is starting screening at 40 every year until 75 or 80, and we're testing that against a more personalized approach. Now, what does that mean? And why did we come up with this personalized approach? Our notion was that if all women don't have the same risk and all cancers aren't the same, why are we screening everybody as if they all had the same risk and were at the risk for the same cancer? That didn't make sense to us. And what we wanted to do was take all we knew about breast cancer risk and put that together in a way that we really would be able to say much more definitively when they should start, stop, and how often to screen. So our personalized program includes doing a comprehensive genetic panel. This includes looking for errors in 9 genes that lead to a much higher rate of getting breast cancer. So BRCA1, BRCA2, PALB2, CDH1, et cetera. There's 9 of those genes. Now, they're not very common, but if you have them, they really do confer high risk. This is something that we've learned over the last, you know, couple of decades. Why aren't we putting that into practice? As well, there's information about the small variations that people inherit in their genes. You know, that's the stuff that makes you a little bit different from your sister or person sitting next to you. So it's there, but there has been a huge amount of work around the world trying to identify several of these, since a couple hundred of these what we call single nucleotide polymorphisms. It's a long, complicated name, but all it means is little small variations. Together, we can put that risk together. We call it polygenic risk, many genes, polygenic risk, PRS. So that PRS score actually does differentiate people in the highest and lowest risk. And so we're adding that to some of the standard tools, the Breast Cancer Screening Consortium risk tool. We add the information about screening, about the genetic risk, breast density, and other risk factors that people have, and we put this comprehensive tool in place to then tell someone, you know, do you have enough risk to start in your 40s, or should you wait until you're 50? If you're 50 or 40, should you do it every year, or should you do it every 2 years? And are you really at an extremely high risk, in which case you should be screened every 6 months and with different modality and with MRI. And I think we may get to this later, but not everybody, I think we have to be careful not to use too much screening. MRI is, you know, it's an expensive test, and it is very sensitive and finds all kinds of things. We're trying to also decrease the harms of screening. And we can get to that later, but there are harms from screening. And so the point is, if we really understand people's risks, can we do more for the people at higher risk and do less safely for the people with lower risk so that we don't unnecessarily expose people to harm when they're not going to get much benefit, but where we're really wanting to look harder for the people who do have more risk. Because they're much more likely to benefit from screening. So this is the basis. This isn't the end. This is the beginning of how we change. And one of the important things we brought into this trial, the Wisdom Study, that's an acronym, mm-hmm. actually. It stands for Women Informed to Screen Depending on Measures of Risk. The idea here is that we are going to start with the best knowledge we have today. And every 6 months, we improve our screening algorithm as information comes available. Because it's a modern era trial, say, we know that information is changing all the time. When new information comes out, we change it. It's just like if you had come in last year and you had no family history, and next year you come in and your sister got diagnosed, I wouldn't say, oh, I'm sorry, I can't take that into account because I started your screening last year and your sister didn't have breast cancer then. No one would do that. That's not how we practice clinical medicine. So our trial should reflect more about what's appropriate for them. So, you know, the U.S. Preventive Task Force guidelines say to go talk to your personal physician to try and figure out what's right for you. I would say, if you're listening, go to wisdomstudy.org and join the Wisdom Study and share your wisdom and help us find the right answer. Because this is one of the most important questions that women have. It's one of the most urgent public health issues because all women are told to screen. And there's so much confusion. We want to really help end that confusion and get us on a path to learning how we can personalize screening. The other thing that we think is important is if you are at higher risk, there are things we can do to lower your risk. Sometimes that's lifestyle, sometimes that's the medicines that we have, like statins can reduce heart disease. There are medicines that are approved. For many people, it's very easy to take. If we can do something to lower your risk, that's always better. That's even more important than screening. And if you're at super high risk, you come from a really family where a lot of people died of the disease, you know, you want to really think about what all your options are. So That's our approach. We recognize that the options and the advice for women out there is not optimal. It's just confusing. And we can't make that confusion better without putting together a modern era study, because most of this data comes from 30 years ago when we didn't even know that breast cancer was there were estrogen positive and estrogen negative and all this information, and there wasn't treatment. There's, you know, today everything is different, and we should be using all the information at our fingertips.
Oh, that's awesome, Dr. Esserman. At this point, I'd like to actually take a question from the audience, and it is It's on screening, so that's why I'm just taking at it at this point. She wants to know, is there evidence to support the use of imaging modalities such as digital tomosynthesis, contrast mammography, MRI, etc., for screening high-risk premenopausal women, previious biopsy with ATPR, family history, no children, no genetic risk factors, who have extremely dense breast tissue that appears solid white in mammogram images? She also wants to know, is there a metric for determining screening frequency and modality, such as a lifetime risk score threshold? And is there value in quantitative transmission ultrasound imaging? I know there's a whole bunch of questions there.
Okay. I think I can handle that. Okay, yeah. So those are all excellent questions. So the majority of people don't have really high risk. But if you do, the recommendation is not to rely only on mammography, but it's to rely on mammography with MRI imaging. I think it's very clear that some kind of contrast-enhanced imaging adds value, and what that, so there's two kinds of, there's, let me break down the screening test for you. So mammography takes ionizing radiation and it goes through the breast, and so anything that's dense will reflect back and look white. The more of that you have, the harder it is to see masses. Now, one thing is true, that mammography sees things called calcifications. These are little deposits of calcium, which are actually pretty common in the breast. And so it's not the actual finding of the calcifications themselves. It is the way, it's the pattern in which they're deposited and the way they're grouped or clustered. And that you can see even in a dense breast. And it often reflects cells dying in the center of something, so that's why it's a good modality in that regard. But the ability to see masses or change in the breast can and the breast architecture is much less if you have very dense breast tissue. The younger you are, the more dense breast tissue you have. As you get older, your breast density gets less. Not always, but most of the time. There's a lot of confusion about what it is you should be using if you have very dense breast tissue, and there's a lot of fans of using ultrasound, but ultrasound in many ways is the same thing. It's taking sound waves, just like the ionizing radiation, and the more dense your breast tissue, you know, the more it will look solid and the harder it is to find things. The problem with ultrasound is you find lots of things. The chance of a false positive is like 90%. It's very high. The chance of a false positive with an MRI is like 40%. It's still very high. So you don't want to use a lot of these modalities unless you've got a good reason for it. Dense breast tissue alone is not a good reason. Dense breast tissue in the setting of higher risk is a good reason. And people at highest risk, our recommendation is every 6 months you alternate a mammogram and an MRI. And one of the reasons is that calcifications is one way to find things. And when you have a contrast-based test, you're putting something in the vein that goes through the bloodstream, and you're looking at how you're looking at the blood flow to the breast. And often tumors will take up that contrast material much faster and then wash it out. That's what we're looking for when you're looking at a contrast-based test, like MRI. Contrast-enhanced mammography is another contrast-based test. It's not used anywhere near as much here, but it actually is very promising and probably less expensive than an MRI, and there are some studies that are testing this, and I think it's a very promising modality. I think some kind of contrast-based imaging for someone at high risk with high breast density is a good idea. And, you know, if you're a mutation carrier or someone who has that level of risk, you know, you start at 10 years before the diagnosis of the youngest family member. So if, you know, someone earliest was 35, then you might start screening it at 30 or even earlier, that there's a lot of breast cancer in the family. When you're younger, we tend to use just the contrast-based imaging tools. because you don't want to be doing a lot of mammography before the age of 30 or 35. So that's how you think about it. And one of the things that we've tried very hard to think about is to make sure that we don't overuse these technologies. And so this idea, so there's starting to be recommendations that everybody with dense breast tissue should go out and get lots of these tests. And sounds like a good idea at the surface, but you have to be careful because you don't really want to have all these workups for false positives. It's very frightening for people. And once you find one thing, then you can get to another and so on. And one of the things I think is important for people to think about, if you have a diagnosis where you've had atypia, that's a marker of risk, but it's also a marker that you would be particularly benefited from an intervention like taking tamoxifen. You know, tamoxifen is a medicine that we use for young women that you can drop the breast cancer risk in half. In fact, with atypia, you can drop that by two-thirds or more. And that actually beats screening any day. You know, so I think it's important to use the information not to also think about what can I do to lower my risk. I feel that the rush to do tons of tests for people, you know, is a potential real problem for women, and we have to be careful not to overdo it with the testing. You know, I think a lot of people don't realize it. I mean, you know, mammography seems like a simple, easy test. But when you look at it across the country, you know, we spend probably about $10 billion a year on screening. It's just one test, and we want to use it wisely and make sure that we're not really, you know, frightening people unnecessarily. So we have to be thoughtful about it. There are a lot of studies now on comparing these different modalities and how to combine them. At the current time, the standard for high-risk women should be MRI alternating with mammography every 6 months, so once a year MRI, once a year mammography. And again, to look for the different ways that you can detect cancer. One is with calcifications and the other is with the uptake of that contrast material. And that's what we propose. There's a lot of people who use ultrasound. Ultrasound is a fantastic diagnostic tool to investigate things that are wrong on MRI or mammography. It's not a great screening tool, even though it's used a lot. It's just something for people to know about. And then tomosynthesis was your last question. And there's a very big study called the TINA study that it's out to try and tell us whether tomosynthesis really adds a lot of value to screening. And it likely adds some, but probably not in the way that people think. It's not. I don't think it's going to be the solution, you know, to people with extremely dense breast tissue where it adds and replaces the IV contrast tools like MRI or contrast-enhanced mammography. I think that there will be a role in the highest-risk women with very dense breast tissue. But again, about 15% of people have very dense breast tissue. But when you look at people who have, you know, so there's four grades of density, fatty breast, scattered fibroglandular densities, that's a B, so it's A, B, C, D, A and B. And then C is, they call heterogeneously dense, meaning patchy density, and D, extremely dense. So C and D, that's half the population. That's a lot. That's not very discriminating. And so saying that we should be doing MRI for everyone, I mean, we would be spending, you know, $50 to $100 billion to do that. That's, you know, we just don't have those. I don't think that's the right way to go. We need to be much, that again tells us we have to have more personalized ways of screening. Who's going to benefit? Who has the risk? Who is it worth? For whom is it really worth doing all this extra workup? And I spent a lot of time in clinic, you know, talking to people who've gotten on the screening cycle. I saw someone yesterday who had had 9 biopsies. Under 9 biopsies, they found a tiny bit of in situ breast cancer. And, you know, it was a tiny bit, and had recommended a bilateral mastectomy. That's not the goal of screening. You don't want to torture someone. She wasn't even 50. Okay, so the goal isn't to torture people until we find something and then take their breath off. That's not reasonable. But that is what happens, and people don't think about it. They say, oh, I got to screen. So we have to learn how to use our information well, and that's the motivation behind the wisdom study, to try and figure out how to tailor screening and prevention in a way that we get the most benefit for the people who have the most to gain.
Thanks, Dr. Simon. That was very, very well explained. At this point, being mindful of time, I'd like to bring in the panel. So we have with us April Stearns, who is a writer. And April was diagnosed at 35 years old with stage 3 breast cancer. And 4 years later, April launched the Wildfire magazine as a way for young women to tell and read breast cancer stories. So April, you're on air. Please ask your questions.
Thank you, Priya. Hi, Dr. Esserman. I'm actually in your backyard in Santa Cruz, so it's a pleasure being on with you. I really appreciate what you were just saying about the need to balance increased screening with common sense, you know, to summarize. I am coming at this from, as Priya said, being a survivor of breast cancer myself. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit to us who've been diagnosed young and now worry about our own daughters. You know, I was diagnosed at 35. I represent women who were diagnosed under 45. And so I hear every day from people who are concerned about their children coming up behind us and wonder about screening for them, not necessarily as children, but as they get older. And I wonder if you could talk about maybe why 40 is the magic number and if self-exam is actually still more or the most effective for people who are younger than that.
So thanks so much for your question, April. Your story actually represents exactly the challenge with screening. And what our notion was in 1980 was, again, that, you know, all cancers kind of grew slowly and that all we had to do was find them early and all would be well. And that if you look at the risk increases with age. And so, you know, if you're screening a million people and one of them might have cancer, that's not common enough to screen. So one of the principles of screening is the disease has to be common. So breast cancer is very common. But the kind of cancer you had was a fast-growing cancer, right? And fast-growing cancers tend more often to happen in young women. And this is, again, one of the principles that's making us rethink screening, that there are some types of cancers that grow very slowly where screening is good, or maybe there are some kinds of cancers that grow so slowly that they would never come to clinical attention, so you don't want to find them. In situ cancer might be one of those. The high risk or the high-grade cancer, the kind of cancer you have, they grow very fast. And they can actually come up in 3 or 4 months. So it's not that you were neglectful and didn't come in time. It's just that you had bad biology. And screening is not going to help us. And, in fact, we're not going to screen our way into a cure for those kinds of cancers. In fact, I run another trial called the I-SPY trial, where we're really trying to optimize the treatments up front for the people who have cancers that are life-threatening. The screening isn't going to be the solution there, and we shouldn't – it's not helpful to us to hope that we're going to screen our way into a cure for that. These kinds of cancers, you know, that are life-threatening from the beginning, you have to figure out how to get the treatment right. So the best thing going forward would be to understand who is at risk for these kinds of cancers. One of the things that we're working on is trying to figure out so the I-SPY trial is really looking at people with stage 3 breast cancer, stage 2 and 3 cancer, particularly 2B, 3B, and say, who are the people at risk for that? We actually are investing in a big project to try and understand better, you know, what are the predisposing risk factors? What would we have? Because if we knew that and we could find those people, we would do something early for them. And the more we know about how to treat them, the more we're going to know about how to prevent them. And we'd love to be able to come up with ways of prevention that don't include prophylactic surgery. You know, for some women who have very early breast cancer, it's driven by BRCA1, but it's not necessarily that, you know, that when you, you know, prophylactic surgery can be a strategy if you want to, if you come from a family where, you know, people have had their many cancers and people have died early. But that's a very, very unusual and small group of people. What we really need to get to is a better understanding of people who get the kinds of cancers that you're describing, because our current screening policy will not help us. But what we can learn from this, from our studies, is trying to develop specific screening tools for people at high risk like this. That's what we're working on, and that's why we hope that some of this genetic profiling, more comprehensive genetic profiling, will help us, as well that there are new tests coming out about breast density and the types of density that you have that may really help us identify, you know, people who are at higher risk. We don't have those tools today. But by saying that we're missing something and admitting that it's a problem and really working hard to find those solutions, that's how we're going to get there. And I certainly hope that we get there before your daughters need that.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I have another question for you, and it goes back to something that you were saying a few minutes ago, and this is with the idea that there are kind of two different ways of screening or times when screening is necessary, and one, like you were saying, is before diagnosis, and the other is later. I've been fortunate enough, lucky enough, to be living no evidence of disease for 7 years now, and my oncologist has a similar feeling about lots of vigilance, it sounds like, as you do, where if we look hard enough, we will find something. And so his point of view is that he doesn't want me living in constant fear of what scans will say. So he has a more minimal approach where I do mammograms. I was doing MRIs. Now I do mammograms yearly on the one breast that I have remaining, and then we do other types of things like MRI and CT when I have specific concerns. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that post-treatment scans and vigilance and how to balance the common sense with not overdoing it.
I think these are excellent questions, and I have to say I agree with your oncologist in the same way. What happens is you don't want your life ruled by fear. When you have a very high-risk cancer, and I don't know the specifics of your cancer, and we can't get into that on the phone here, but what I would say is for many women, these very aggressive high-risk breast cancers, the biggest risk of recurrence is usually in the first 5 years. Depending again on the biology. There are, you know, if you have a hormone-driven cancer that's of lower grade, your risk isn't as high, but it persists a much longer period of time. But those aren't fast-growing. So if in the aftermath of a very aggressive cancer that really wasn't easy to find, it's reasonable to get an MRI once a year in that early post period of follow-up, maybe up to 5 years. But then after that, and it also depends on the breast density, but then after that, you have to say, well, what's my risk of developing another cancer in my lifetime? Especially if you've had a mastectomy on one side, you're really looking at the other, you know, that's in the setting of the breast remaining. But once you've had that breast, if the breast is removed, you have to say, what's my risk of getting a cancer on the other side? And it's a little bit different for the tumor type. So again, we need wisdom for screening after breast cancer as well, and we're working on a pilot for that that's based on your tumor type, your breast density, you know, and other risk factors, again, so we can try and create some real rationality to how we screen, because especially if you've had cancer, if you get called back, it's like post-traumatic stress disorder, and people are called back, and it's just debilitating for people, and you have to, And that's, you know, it's been proven that you, at this time, you know, screening and doing all these, you know, looking for metastatic disease, it's, you know, the ASCO guidelines, the American Society of Clinical Oncology guidelines, say very clearly that you shouldn't be doing screening tests because all they do is ruin your quality of life. If you have a specific symptom, that will come up within 2 months. So it's, and finding it early doesn't make your treatment any more effective. So, you know, constantly looking and trying to find something is not good just because you have risk. So these are the things that have to be separated. And, you know, if you're not a mutation carrier and there wasn't another reason, you know, once you've gotten, you're in your mid-40s, you know, an annual mammogram is probably all you need. And that's, you know, again, with the specifics, that's one of the things that, you know, your oncologist knows you and knows your risk factors. That's the right kind of conversation to have. And, you know, doing more may feel better until you get called back. One of the things we know is that after 10 years of screening, 50% of people will get called back. So, you know, even if the false positive rate isn't super high, cumulatively when you're doing something frequently, that leads to, you know, a lot of trauma, a lot of callbacks, and 75% of what we call people back for turn out to be a biopsies even turn out to be nothing. So it's, you know, I think the stakes are even higher when you've had a cancer, when you get called back. It's just so frightening. So we just need to do better. And I do think that our technology is going to improve. The kinds of tests that we can use will improve. And the ways in which we can screen for recurrence is going to improve a lot over time. And needs to.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for that. I really, really appreciate that approach.
Thanks, April. I think we'll just go over Kelsey, and if you have time, we'll round up back to you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Our next panelist is Kelsey Smith, and Kelsey was diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer in 2014 at the age of 29. She started the Cancer Survivor Network, an advocacy organization focusing on elimination of financial toxicity caused by a cancer diagnosis. And she also hosts a weekly podcast which chronicles stories of survival, second chances, and ingenuity. So Kelsey, you're on air. Please ask your questions.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for having me on the show today.
Hi, Kelsey.
Thanks, Stephanie.
Hi. It's so nice to meet you. It's so nice to meet everybody. Dr. Esterman, I have a question for you. Kind of piggybacking off of April's question, we kind of discussed the fear. And as a patient advocate, for not only my own sake, but also to kind of keep my constituents informed, I tend to go through with some of the screening. So, for instance, I'm, you know, undergoing the BCI testing right now to determine what my risk of reoccurrence is within 5 to 10 years. So I do like to screen. However, one word that is very well known within our community and our culture is scanxiety. So from a provider's perspective, what kind of advice or what do you think we should do to help lower patients' scanxiety around these screening tests and such?
So one of the things that I try and tell my patients is that I said, look, if I'm going to screen you with an MRI, if I'm going to even get an MRI, I want to prepare you for what can happen, and I want to prepare you for what you might read from the radiology report and what my job is as a provider to interpret those results. So even if you have a cancer, you know, you can say, okay, here's what will happen with that MRI. It could be that the rest of the breast and everything is completely clear and we just see this one cancer. That's possible. It could be, on the other hand, that we see something very obvious that's cancer and clearly needs to be worked up. And then there's all the stuff in between, which is the most likely, that there's going to be some stuff that might be cancer that we have to work up, but not necessarily. And there's a bunch of stuff that's just going to light up everywhere. And that doesn't mean that you have cancer everywhere. Well, I mean, one of the complaints that people have about MRI and the use of MRI is it's pushed people to, it has increased, it is blamed for the increase use of bilateral mastectomy and prophylactic control, mastectomy, taking the other breast off on the other side. I think that is pretty clear. I think once you start sticking your needle in and checking things and looking here and looking there, it can get you there. But we have tons of data that breast conservation works before we, you know, even, you know, and that the use of MRI doesn't necessarily, like, improve your ability to find other things. It increases the mastectomy risk but doesn't, you know, change your local recurrence rates, meaning that, you know, little tiny little things here and there, even if they turned out to be cancer, are probably dealt with by radiation, you know, or whatever your treatment is. So you have to, we have to put that in perspective. And I think it's really important for providers to warn people to say, and if someone is super, super anxious, you really have to weigh whether you should get a screening test that has a really high sensitivity, but it's not that specific, meaning it's, you know, if it finds something, it doesn't mean it's necessarily a cancer. Because a lot of these things have to be worked up, or there may be some things that are kind of like a little this, a little that, and you just don't work them up. There's a lot of stuff I don't work up. Now, that doesn't mean the radiologist will write a report calling it that. The radiologists are going to write a report where they describe everything they see. They're not writing it for you. They're writing it for them. And they're writing it because that's the standard in which they're trained, and that's, they don't want to take any risk. They just want to describe everything. It's the clinician's job to interpret it, and the radiologists always say, if anything's there, recommend biopsy. But that doesn't always mean that you have to have a biopsy. If something's really obviously wrong, yes, you want to get a biopsy. But lots of little details, you can't often work all that stuff up. And it's just so anxiety-provoking. So I think you have, providers have to have a conversation with people to say that there's lots of stuff that lights up in the background. And, you know, and a lot of times that just, stuff just goes away, especially when someone's high risk. If they take tamoxifen, the next MRI they have, things are much quieter and easier to see. So there are, I think it's important for people to be prepared and to know that, and that every little thing that lights up isn't something.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes, there's definitely a lot of anxiety, so that's a great, great answer.
And that's also, if you're getting a PET scan or any of these other things, that lots of things light up. One of the reasons why we recommend PET CTs at UCSF instead of CT, bone scan, everything else, is because it's one test. And if something lights up on one test, and it's like it's one test that combines two modalities, PET and CT. And if something lights up on the PET, but there's no finding on the CT, or something's on the CT and you don't see anything on the PET, you know it's nothing. And you can drop the number of false positives in half by doing that. And it's so much better for the anxiety of a patient. So, it's unfortunate that we've gotten into a cycle where these are not covered by insurance, but in fact, it's a much more cost-effective way to scan someone, and we're working on trying to get awareness in the insurance company. We've just published something to show that it drops the false positive rates in half, and it actually is cost-effective. And so it's a much more patient-centered tool, and so we're trying to get a change, a sea change in the way people look at it. But it's very important that, if you get a scan and then you find that some, like, 1 centimeter thing on the adrenal gland or something over there, you're not looking for it, it's round, you know, you got to stop. That's not what you went for. People have to remember that. The patients have to remember it. The physicians have to remember it.
And that is a great segue into my final question. And I want to bring up the fact that screenings, yes, like you had mentioned, they can be quite pricey for patients. But sometimes they can paint a better picture of a patient's diagnosis to help with treatment. And so how are cost barriers being evaluated to expand access to care?
Gosh, you know, that's such a great question. And this is something that I worry about a lot, that, you know, increasingly I'm seeing people have health plans where they're paying a 20% copay. You know, that's one thing if you're got a $100 test. It's another thing if you're getting a $5,000 test or a $3,000 test. And so I think that it's important for people to ask and not be afraid to ask, you know, what's my copay and what is this going to cost me? And if it's not covered, why is it not covered? Is it really important? And what am I going to pay personally? And can I afford that? And to talk to your physician about it, not to be afraid or not to think that you're not being compliant. It is, you know, physicians often have absolutely no idea what patients face in terms of copays. You know, it really depends how you're in, what your insurance is. If you're in a closed system like the Kaiser, you may not see that, but in, you know, in a lot of the commercial insurance plans, you can be charged what amounts to be $1,500 for one of these scans, an MRI or something. And so you need to know that up front and to know and to really sit down and think about it. What are you likely to gain? You know, what's the cost? And, you know, it's not just getting the scan. If you find something that lights up, you know, so the things that we often bias these, sometimes only 5% of those in the setting of cancer turn out to be a cancer. So that's a lot of workup, and you're paying 20% copay for all that. This is something we all have to think about as a society, and I think it's important to just be aware so that you're not caught unaware. And I know that a lot of patients can, you know, experience a significant out-of-pocket cost of the diagnosis of cancer, and it's something we all have to work on. There are most communities have funds and ways in which you can get support and get help if you can't afford it. But I think everyone has to stop and think about if it's like, oh, well, it might be nice to have, but it's not really indicated. If it's going to cost you a ton of money and it's not really indicated, don't do it. If it's really important, then you should do it. And but those are conversations that everybody can have with their physicians and should have with them.
Yes, and I will say too, I do believe that that also needs to happen within the corporations and having these talks about what kind of clinical trials and things are we going to invest in per R&D, because the thing is as you continue to, you know, if you have a misstep, you have to go backwards, and then that incurs additional costs, and that gets rolled into the cost of some of these tests and some of these screenings. So,
I agree. And one of the, so in our wisdom study, one of the things that we're trying to do is we're trying to get the insurers to cover the cost of the test, because it actually turns out that when you personalize things, it's not more expensive. It's actually, in the long run, you know, a better way to spend resources, because you're spending more for the people that need it and less for the people that don't. And we have a bargain where we're funded by the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, started by the Affordable Care Act, that's PCORI. But their deal is that we have to work with the insurers to cover the cost of the test. So we've tried to put this forward as a coverage with evidence development, or coverage with evidence progression, with the idea is that many of the things that we do today don't have enough evidence. It's like you can't use evidence-based medicine because it's really not appropriate for what we know today or the pace of change in science. So what we need to do more of is put studies and trials together where we are generating the evidence, and everyone has a stake: patients, physicians, insurers, you know, advocates. Everyone's at the table saying, look, we need to generate this evidence. We'll all look at it. We'll all make decisions. But we all need to go forward and try and make it better. We don't want to stick with how things were 10 years ago. We want to move into the future and help generate the evidence to do a better job. So I think this is a really important sea change for how we think about doing things better going forward. Some of the trials we're trying to optimize, you know, care, where we can learn early on who's getting a good response, figure out who needs more therapy and who needs less. This is really important, but the insurer should come to the table and start helping us to fund those studies so that everyone has the data and we can more rapidly get these tailored approaches to patients.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. And I know that gets to the issue, you know, April, you had about toxicity, right? And how do you manage that?
Yes, definitely.
And I think that, you know, I think this is like what we tend to do in medicine is when people have high risk, everyone gets worried and frightened, and everybody then gets everything. We don't want to leave any stone unturned, which is fine.
We throw all the darts at the board.
Give everybody everything. And at the moment, you're so afraid and there's so much risk, that's all you can think about. But people live a long time with the consequences of that. neuropathy in their hands where they don't have right sensation, you know, the fatigue, it can take years to get better, some of the immune side effects, and so on. It's a lot. It's a lot. And, you know, Susan Love calls it collateral damage from, you know, cancer treatment, right? So I think it's actually essential that we do better than just give everybody everything, that we can personalize our treatments too. In the I-SPY trial, one of the things we're working on is trying to figure out, well, who needs what? How can we learn about these, you know, signatures and the tumors that tell us, well, this person needs immune therapy, or maybe this person needs a DNA repair damage, and maybe we can figure out how to get this less toxic. And we know if we start the treatment first, if you have a big cancer, you shouldn't go to the OR. I'm a surgeon. I'm telling you that. That's not the right thing to do. Because if your cancer is going to kill you, you got to know what's going to treat it best. And so what you're looking for is what can make that tumor reduce or go away. And we can use that as an early endpoint. And if your treatment, if a small amount of treatment gets you to that great endpoint, stop and go on and skip some of the other toxic things. But if not, we want to work. We're working in I-SPY to try and give people multiple shots on goal to figure out how do we do it. We start with least toxic to most toxic. Do I know that that's the right way? Of course not. But that's what we want to test because that would address it. Maybe everybody doesn't need everything. And patients care about toxicity, right?
Yes, absolutely. So thank you, April, and thank you, Kelsey. Dr. Simon, we have some questions that have been sent in by our audience, and I think we could go over some of them. We did cover a couple of them while we were discussing. Earlier, you touched upon your trial, the wisdom trial, and screening modalities, etc. So one question that's just come up is, how different is the treatment and prognosis in breast cancer in males as compared to breast cancer of females?
So breast cancer in men, it does occur, but it's at a hundredth of the frequency in women. So it's really quite uncommon. So if it's, you know, 1 in 12 women who get breast cancer, it's about 1 in 1,200 men who, in their lifetime, would get male breast cancer. And again, it's not frequent enough that we would screen for it. This actually comes back to one of the questions, actually, April, that you asked me that I did not answer. And that is, everybody should be aware. You asked about self-breast exam, and especially in your 20s and 30s. And it is really important. If you're screening and you have a normal mammogram, and 3 months later you feel a mass in your breast, and it's new, and you know it's new, go get that checked out. And if you are a man and you feel a new mass under your breast tissue or your nipple tissue, don't be embarrassed. Don't be afraid. Bring it up. That's actually one of the things that happens, why, you know, I think a lot of men who might find things think, oh, I don't need to, this won't happen to me. Or some of the 29, oh, this won't happen to me. If you have a new mass, it can happen. So the message is to be aware of your body. You don't have to do a 30-minute breast exam. You can do a 2-minute breast exam and just have a good sense of, you know, when you get in the shower once a month, just get in the habit of just feeling your body and just seeing, is there something new? Get to know what your body feels like. So everything in it, you know, breasts are lumpy, bumpy. So lumps and bumps are fine. But is there something new that's different and clearly growing? You'll notice it. You know, that 50% of women still come in and detect their cancers themselves. Many of those are in between screens. So that's just as important as screening. Be aware and make sure you bring that to your attention. Not every little thing. You get to be familiar with your body. And if you see something that's new or different that persists, not something that's there for 1 day or 5 days or 3 weeks, but something that's there, you know, for more than a month or is really changing, is not going away, bring that to the attention of your physician, male or female.
Thank you, Doctor. So we have our next question, and it is, I'm enrolled in UCSS I-SPY trial and interested in how you see the progress of the trial going so far. What have you learned, and what new drugs look promising?
Well, great question. So we actually have tested now almost 18 different drug combinations, and in the people who have been on the arms for treatment, we have doubled the chances that tumors would go away. So there's no question that there are new medicines. And in fact, one of the immune agents has just shown in a confirmatory trial, you know, that the that you can really dramatically improve the chance of getting a complete response in the triple negative breast cancer tumors. And so this is really exciting. The regimen that they used actually is a little bit of the kitchen sink regimen. We think that in our trial we had almost as good results without as much toxicity. And we think the next step in the trial is to be able to figure out how do we start to tailor giving different combinations of patients different treatments and learning how they're working and testing some of the less toxic, hopefully less toxic treatments, but then to also work on trying to tailor for every patient based on their tumor subtypes or prediction of DNA repair problems or immune signaling, ways that we can start to optimize combinations of therapies. That's what's next. So trying to optimize treatment based on your tumor biology. And then if you get to a complete response by measuring as you go, you can stop and not give more than you need. That's the next phase of I-SPY that we're moving into. I think that there are the kinds of things that are happening is that there are ways to enhance immune signaling. I think those combinations look very promising. There are also ways to enhance DNA where when if there's already a defect in the way you repair errors in how the cells turn, you know, copy themselves, that DNA repair deficiency or something like that. If you have that kind of tumor, there may be ways in which you can kind of hype that up, you know, really, you know, cut off the blood supply, make that worse. And then you can come in with one of these more targeted agents. So I think there's really exciting things. And then we know that there still are some tumors that just don't respond to any of that at all. And what's going to be the rescue for that? How do we learn to target patients who have leftover tumor? And one of the things we can do with that is then maybe that's where some of the stem cell or that's, I think that's where all the science and biology of the last 20 years is going to help us really start targeting drugs to specific cancers so we can get not too much, not too little, but just right. So the idea if you have more risk and less response, you get more therapy. But if you have either less risk or you have a great response to therapy, you can do less. So that's the essence of personalizing medicine.
Thank you, doctor. Actually, we have quite a few more, but no time, I guess. So I just have one more question before we wrap today's show up. And this is like, I don't know how many folks who are listening know this, that Dr. Essaman loves to sing and sings to all her patients before surgery, sometimes a song of their request. Dr. Essaman, I think that this is amazing. When did you start doing this?
I actually started doing that almost 23 years ago, and I was actually in a situation where everyone was really stressed in the OR, including me, and I just couldn't think of anything else to do. And I had just seen The Phantom of the Opera the night before, and I asked my patient if she liked music from that, and I started to sing to her her favorite song from the show, and she was on the blood pressure monitor, and her systolic blood pressure dropped 40 points. I think mine probably did, too. Anyway, I thought, and so then I started singing a few songs, and then I realized, you know, what I could do is, I love to sing, and I've been a musician all my life, my hobby is that what's really best is to have someone pick a song that's really meaningful to them and learn that song for them, and that's just so comforting, and it just, you know, it's just such a lovely, it's a very lovely moment that you can have, and you take people away from the fear of being in an operating room or in a difficult situation and feel comforted. That's really kind of, that's the art of medicine. So it's one of the things
Absolutely.
That I love to do.
Such a beautiful gesture, Dr. Essaman. Thank you so very much. And we've learned, audience, that the screening is looking for signs of disease before a person has symptoms. Sometimes a screening test finds cancer that is very small or very slow growing. These cancers are unlikely to cause death or illness during the person's lifetime. So the goal of screening tests is to find cancer at an early stage when it can be treated and may be cured. Thank you very much once again, Dr. Esselman, for your time and for all the information shared. I think this 1 hour just flew by, and we still have questions. Thank you for your participation. And April and Kelsey, you brought in the patient perspective onto the table and to the discussion. Well, thanks a lot for that. We also like to thank UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center and the audience. Please visit our website for details on upcoming talks. Thank you, everyone, and have a great day.